Guardian Podcasts are partnered with audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/audible, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.
Hello, I'm Kieran Yates. Welcome to Music Weekly.
And I'm Michael Hand, sitting in for Alexis Petridis.
Coming up, we have Michael talking to James Fenley about life in the Pogues, as told in his new book.
Alexis met Willie Moon, the man who's giving electronic music a touch of rockabilly.
And as usual, we'll be auditioning three new tracks in Singles Club.
And today, Kieran, we have a fantastic special guest joining us right here in this studio.
We do. Oh, welcome, Jude Rogers.
That's quite a frightening build-up there.
Well, Jude, we always think of you as fantastic.
Oh, you're very kind.
So you, Jude, are the one music writer in London who got to see the XX this week.
I did see them on Tuesday. I paid my way because no press were allowed, although there were a few other journalists who also paid their way. Yes, okay. But all very, you know, above board. Yes, I did. I saw them in Chats Palace, which is in Homerton, a rapidly becoming fashionable part of East London, which it wasn't 5 years ago when I lived there, I tell you. A very, very small venue. And they played for probably about 45 minutes to an hour. They played quite a lot of old stuff, but they played about five or six new tracks from
the
forthcoming record.
And how did the new song sound?
They sound pretty good. Not any massive advance in style in some ways with a few of the tracks. Two tracks stood out. One that Oliver sang by himself, which was really fantastic. Quite a... He's turning to a slightly... a bit of a crooner. Which I like, because I love Oliver's voice. A lot of people don't. I do. And there's one which had lots of beats and had a very much of a kind of... I couldn't work out if it was trying to go for a slightly Afrobeat sound, but Jamie XX, who obviously did his album last year with Gil Scott-Heron, it was very influenced by the sounds of that. And he had a steel pan on stage, and he had a tom drum.
Oh.
Very exciting. Ooh. So, yeah, it was the second gig back after 2 years. So it was a little bit rusty at points, but they acknowledged that. But, yeah, it was very exciting. I'm excited about the new record.
It can't have been as exciting as Steps Back on the Road Again, which, as everyone knows, is my favourite live music.
Are you still addicted to it?
Yeah, I've not caught up with this week's yet.
Is though. Claire losing weight as the show progresses?
Oh, Claire. Oh. I worry about Claire. But Claire's getting very fed up of being asked about her weight all the time.
Oh,
you understand why they're asking. But then the other big news this week, and this is the point where I, Michael Hand, surprise you, Kieran Yates.
Go.
Is that once upon a time, Kieran, there's a time when I used to go and see a lot of funk bands.
What?
And the sad news this week has been the death of Chuck Brown, the godfather of go-go, because it was indeed go-go bands I used to go and see when I was living in Washington, D.C. Chuck Brown, the Soul Searchers, Trouble Funk, EU, Reds and the Boys, Little Benny and the Masters. And Chuck Brown will be sorely missed. The man who pioneered the go-go thing of not breaking between songs, just keeping the beat running. And so every go-go show turns into just a three-hour single song.
Did you have a funk wardrobe?
Yes. What did the young Michael Han wear to a go-go gig?
You'll be surprised to know that actually I was going to watch these go-go bands in Washington, D.C., clad in a tweed jacket, black jumper, paisley shirt, black jeans and Chelsea boots. I didn't look very funk. I still looked indie.
Sound exactly the same.
Funky on the inside.
It was like indie funk crossover, like way ahead of its time. It was like totally there. Yeah, if we match the Mary Chain to Trouble Funk, it'd be like so amazing.
But you just emanate funk from yourself anyway, so it doesn't really matter.
Well, you're like a smell, aren't you? That's a 1920s public school usage, wasn't it? I say, hands a bit funky. Send him down to the lower fourth.
Don't know what that means. I went to see Wiley at Eskimo Dance last week, which was good and crazy. There was like three checkpoints to get in, so it took me a really long time to get in. They've kind of amped up their security from
last
time.
The things they'll do to stop people bringing in their own sweets.
I know. I know, right? But yes, that was very good and very corporate, very Smirnoff iced out. And so at one stage, there was this 15-foot guy in this sort of, you know, those Lycra bodysuit things in stilts with these red and white lights all on him with relentless flashing Smirnoff adverts in the background before the Ryman Seas came on. Yeah, which was pretty weird, which is a far cry from Jammer's basement.
Yes, indeed.
The O2. Bad venue, good rave. Right, moving on. Michael, you've been talking to James Fearnley this week, haven't you?
That's right. James Fearnley was the, and still is, the accordion player in the Pogues, who, back when I was a teenager, were the most extraordinarily exciting live band I could possibly imagine. He came into our studios to talk about life on the road, which could be fairly dismal, the changing face of London, and many other things besides.
I've been loving you a long time. Down all the years, down all the days. And I've cried for all your troubles. Smile, it's your funny little way.
It sounds at times like it was fairly wretched being in the Pogues.
I wouldn't like to contest straight away just starting a podcast with you. But I mean, yes, a lot of there's some desperation in there, and a lot of misery and pain and stuff. But all the way through, I think it does have like a positive message in the end, which is how human beings can figure a big, big problem out.
Now, for all that the music was Irish and the Pogues are associated with Irish music, the truth is they're actually one of the great London groups, weren't they?
Yeah, no, the misconception that I find a lot is your accent's not Irish, where are you from? Then I tell them that I live in Los Angeles as well, and that kind of makes it worse. But yeah, no, we've been mistaken for Irish a lot, and we've suffered from the prejudices against Irish people right from the very start. We were the drinking thing was notably, because we were supposedly an Irish band, then we had to be drunk all the time. I think we were drunk all the time just because we were in rock and roll. That's how I think that works. And there was a lot of drinking to be done sometimes just to get through it, so you could have fun at the slog that you commit to when you get into any band will tell you. You know, the back doors of the van are open, you get in it and you don't get off until unless you play for people, then you get on it again and keep going.
But it's not just about your geographical location or any of that. It's about the fact that lots of the Pogues' best songs were about London. They were about a side of London that most people didn't see, or they were fantastic romantic portrayals of London, like A Rainy Night in Soho.
Sure.
I mean, you've got the two sides, London, Transmetropolitan and A Rainy Night in Soho, haven't you? I mean, they're kind of inspiring pictures of a city. And I sometimes think that side doesn't get the credit that it's due.
That's true, indeed. I don't think that's the first thing that people hear. I mean, I loved Transmetropolitan just as like a mission statement sort of thing. It used to be like lock up your daughters, but we were just billed in Australia's lock up your mothers. so we got to that particular vintage now. In a rosy parts of England, we're sitting and have a drink.
Now, I saw the Pogues a fair bit in the mid-80s, and they were some of the most thrilling shows I've ever been to. But they were thrilling because of the imminent threat that something appalling was going to happen.
Can I tell you a story around this, which will turn that on its face? But I'm friendly with Kathy Burke. I'm sure you know the name. She came to, I think, a gig at National. I think it was there that she was in the mosh pit, and there's loads of people rammed together right at the front where it's at its scariest. And she sort of felt something by her face. And she touched her ear and she realised that one of her earrings had disappeared. So she says, fight! And she cleared an area and all these guys just made a circle around her. And she, they all looked down on the ground, and there's the earring. And she picked it up, and she says, "Oh!" And then the whole thing closed up again. So they're not as scary as, I mean, I can imagine that those crowds are scary, but they do have the sensitivity in them, and to just, you know, do that sort of thing.
There was a sense that Pogues gigs were places where people went to lose themselves of every single inhibition, though, wasn't there?
Yeah, and their shoes and underwear sometimes. And actually, in Australia just now, somebody threw up a prosthetic limb. So they like to lose all sorts of things at gigs. And it's interesting you should say that as well, because I think one of the things that Shane always wanted to do with music was to have that sort of consciousness squishing, sort of extinguishing thing.
He comes across as sphinx-like and unknowable. Was that how he felt when you were around him?
That's completely stumped me. I've never considered him to be like sphinx-like. I kind of get it. I think I was as a person, I was always attracted to guys who knew something that it seemed like I couldn't possibly know. Somehow, and it's not that I wanted to get from them anything particularly, and I don't know what it was that sort of drew me to people like that. There was a guy at school, as I remember, who would talk to me at night. I went to a boarding school, and we used to hang out on the pipes at the end of the dormitory corridors, and he would talk to me about stuff that I had no idea what he was talking about, but it felt like important. And Shane was the same way. He's got, "I've got to try and figure this out, what he's trying to say," which was, I find it that really attractive for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, it's not so much that he's unpredictable. Well, clearly unpredictability enters into it.
Yeah.
Although towards the end, it becomes grimly predictable, a large chunk of what's happening with him.
Mm.
It's more that he presents only tiny facets of himself at a time in the book. You never really get the sense ever that you will know Shane McGowan. And I kind of get that feeling from some of the things that you write about him. You know, your reactions to him at times, thinking, this is what people will expect. Like when you're walking home from Camden and he's dead drunk and pauses to vomit, and you move to put your hand on his shoulder and he rears up and screams abuse at you.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah.
A complicated man.
He is a complicated man, and I think this is in the book as well. The boring figure, and the, is it called the Reuben vase or something? You know, where it's either a candlestick or it's two faces staring at one another, and you cannot. The mind is not capable of seeing both at the same time, and that's like with Shane. And I do think I end up that paragraph saying whether or not he was a genius or a fucking idiot. Mm.
Could those songs that he wrote have emerged without all the problematic parts of his character?
I'd say not. I think it's just, you can, I don't, it sounds flippant to say you get dealt certain things, but I think you do. You get dealt certain things.
Because even the joy in his songs, when there's joy, it's always undercut by something as well.
Those things, there's a word for it in rhetoric, is where you hand something out in generosity and then you just slap them, say you can't have that. Mm. And lots of his songs start out that way.
I've not seen the Reform Pogues. What's the situation with Shane on stage now? Most of the songs sung by the audience. With cues
No, not at all.
He can get through it all.
Yes, no, he can, yeah. Mm. He's not so sure on his pins anymore. You know, he's 54 and he's lived a life out on the prow of the ship with every wave that comes along, you know, belting him, which that was the job that he got, and I'm glad that he got that job and not me, which is something I wanted to say earlier, that we're given people like Shane McGowan in order that we don't have to take the full force of the cosmos, really. He's like the Earth's magnetic field keeping the solar rays from burning us all to a crisp. That's why I think he's there. And I don't think I'm being too fanciful. I'm perhaps being a bit fanciful. And as I say at the end of the book as well, you know, the Jewish creation myth where the vessels break, you know, that inspired Leonard Cohen's song about that's how the light gets in. Shane McGowan's How the Light Gets In for me. He sings most of the songs and sings them well. He has no teeth at all now. But I did notice a couple of gigs ago how he has compensated for the complete lack of teeth. You know, he had new teeth made, but he was not comfortable wearing them. And in order to get the new teeth made, all the teeth had to come out. And I remember being disappointed hearing a recording of one of the first gigs in 2001. But since working since 2001 on a sporadic sort of basis, he's figured out how to do the diction now. And it actually sounds pretty good. And he's committed, enjoys touring for the most part. When he doesn't enjoy it, then things start to go, you know, the wheels wobbles a little bit. But it's mostly if he's enjoying what he's doing and wants to do it, whereas the story of my book is him trying to tell us that he doesn't want to do it. So we're a bit more sensitive now, having learned our lesson, to what's going on with him, as much as touring schedules and travelling will allow.
The songs still mean, it's not just nostalgia in terms of the meaning that they hold for people. I mean, there are groups who still revive those songs, like the Decembrists offshoot KMRIA, playing Rum Sodomy and The Lash in its entirety for St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah.
So people do still treasure the songs. Does that level of loyalty to these songs, best part of 30 years old, surprise you?
No, because they're timeless classics. I say with a little smile on my face because it sounds sort of, you know...
You don't need to do a mocking smile because it's true.
No, they are timeless classics. Yeah, it's... That's basically it.
Their songs are... The best of those songs are songs like the Sickbed of Cuchulain, the songs that are about the past and the present and the future simultaneously and that never dates.
I think.
And our last one, James... Can you still hoist your accordion above
your
head?
Yeah, I do. Absolutely, I do. When we come off, after the first bit of the show, when we know we're going to do an encore, it's just how, you know, encores are a joke, but you do them. And when I come back out, I have to clear everybody out of the way because I take a knee slide right the way across the stage because I've got carpet layers, knee pads. nobody knows. When the material's gone on the pants, I throw suits in the bin quite a lot after the end of tours. When the material's gone and I've got that connection between a wooden stage, hopefully, and these carpet layers, knee pads, plastic sort of shells on your knees, you can travel quite a distance. And for a 57-year-old guy to be able to do that, you can't knock it. And the accordion does go over the head and jumps off the drum riser and along the front and everything. I'm in the time of my life, really.
The Bruce Springsteen of the accordion.
I found Bruce Springsteen really inspiring, actually. I don't think I'd be doing what I do on stage, you know, showing off as arrantly as I do, if I hadn't seen that film about Bruce Springsteen doing what he does.
James Fearnley, thank you so much for coming in.
Nice talking to you.
Here Comes Everybody is published by Faber and Faber, and it's an excellent read, heartily recommended.
Okay, time for Singles Club. Here's my tune.
You two day from kill a foshi. I love my life, my bun no shi. The God would they bless me no day. Oh, yeah, everybody side wale. Blood the two to him, I call him male. Blood the two to him, I be male man. Blood the two to him, I fire shayo. Oh yeah, everybody follow me, go. SDK and the wizard on the show. Hear me boys, so fly with the go. Bad belly, people please carry go. Follow me, go.
That was Baddest Boy by Wizkid.
Tell us about WizKid.
Yes.
Go on, Kieran.
Wizkid is a 22-year-old Nigerian pop singer who is really sort of at the forefront of the Afrobeats movement, which has really blown up in the last year. I mean, really, you know, it's been really big. There was a big Afrobeats festival last year at HMV, which he performed at, and of course he won the Best African Act at the Mobos last year. So there has been this kind of burgeoning interest, I think, in the UK with Afrobeats. And I think that now with him paired with Debange and DJ Abrantree on Choice FM, there's been, and I think there's a new night that's happening this weekend called Hot to the New that's just opened in Dulston, which is just, you know, just Afrobeats all night. I think that there's the kind of this real trend, and I think that this music is really needs a little bit more airtime.
I heard about Afrobeats, plural, the first time about a month ago.
Right, okay.
And I always thought it was the same as Afrobeat.
Oh, get
with it,
but it's
not the same. No, I know. No, and then I was getting very confused. Like, how are all these young
Well, it's a lot younger, isn't it? It's
young Nigerian boys kind of, you know, kind of doing this stuff that, you know, whatever.
Well, it's interesting because it is a little bit young hipsters here, but also that it's, I mean, in Africa, from what I've seen and from other live shows that Wizkid has done, it's very tween audience, and it's, you know, all these kind of crazy girls.
This is the mainstream pop of
West Africa. Yes, exactly. And they love Wizkid. He just did this thing, which is, you know, this promotion of Win a Date with Wizkid. And he's had, you know, and then so these sort of African teenage girls do these YouTube videos, and they're just like, oh, I love you. Oh my God, Wizkid.
I love that. And then, you know, obviously, I don't know anything about Afrobeats because I've just revealed that. But yeah, I like that.
Well, it's really exciting, isn't it?
Is Wizkid signed to a major? Because I know Debange is.
Yes, he signed to Akon's label Convict, and he's doing stuff with Tiny Temper later in the year. He's also a really big fan, and yeah, he's got that sort of cosign from Akon.
Sorry, I was gonna ask who produces him, because the sound of it made me think, you know, because I love the Tiny Temper record, it felt that kind of very kind of full on kind of a synthy sort of feel to it.
Okay, yeah, I think it's a little bit more, I don't know, traditional than what Labyrinth does with Tiny Temper, which is a little bit bigger and a little bit glossier, a little bit shinier. Whereas this, what I like about this is that there is that sense of that high energy that you get from dancehall and bashment, but it's a little bit more conservative. It's a little bit more stripped back. And of course, there's less sex talk. No talk of daggering or riding a cocky or anything like that in Afrobeats.
Is there a chance, you think, that these Afrobeats acts, what's going to happen to them is what's happened to British hip-hop and grime MCs over the last few years, which is, as they've got incorporated into the mainstream, they've turned into pop singers, and a lot of the original fan bases raised their eyebrows and said, hang on, that's not what we promoted you in the first place for.
I think that would be interesting, but I think that what's different is the kind of that real holding on to the Afrocentricity. You know, they kind of rap in English, but also in Yoruba and kind of other African dialects. So what I think would be a difficulty with really stepping into mainstream, I think that it'd be great with club tracks. I think they're really big club tracks. They're great high energy tracks, but because they are very, very African, very Afrocentric, and you can hear that, there is this real kind of, I don't know, holding on to that identity. So I don't know how that would cross over. But I think that's what makes it so exciting. Mm. And I think as soon as it starts getting glossy and as soon as you start David Guettering it up, then you can only go downhill from there, can't it? But yeah, what did you think, Michael?
Kieran, last time I was on this show and tried talking about one of your songs, I got upbraided thoroughly on the thread beneath. I feel that I should actually be formally disqualified from talking about this, because I will only embarrass myself, our listeners, and possibly you.
Does it make you want to dance at least, though, Michael?
I rarely dance anymore, Kieran.
Did you mind the grammatical, you know, error? You know, badder, shouldn't it be worst boy?
Well, I don't know how many there are. There's only two of them. It should, of course, be badder boy.
I'm thinking of you, you know, you could have, you know, you're a stickler for copy, Michael.
I suspect if you let me near the rhymes of these MCs in proof form, they'll be coming back with a lot of red ink on. But, you know, I think, Jude, it would be me who'd miss the point,
look,
not them.
Michael, he's got a tour in June. Let's just go together. Let's just go. We'll dance it out.
Hot
and
date.
Then we'll see. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how you feel after that. What about you, Jude?
Only if you come and see my group when they tour.
I saw the Civil Wars and I really liked them. They were fantastic. So maybe. Jude, what did you think?
Yeah, I liked it. I liked it. I really liked it. It's like a good pop song. You know what I mean? You know, and that's why I like good pop songs.
It had a good beat.
It had a good beat.
Yeah, so this is from his forthcoming album, but his album Superstar is out now. Next up, let's hear Michael's choice.
So
That was Hak Al Yakin by Om from their forthcoming album Advaitic Songs.
That was indeed. Now, the reason I brought this in, Kieran, is actually because there's something else that's been re-released in the last couple of weeks, which is an album called Dope Smoker by Sleep, which was Sleep were a heavy metal band. We're talking about the early mid-90s. They were signed by London Records, and for their major label debut, they presented an album that was 61 minutes long and had one song. And from the title Dope Smoker, you might guess what the general theme of it was.
It was just like the WizKid record.
London Records weren't that happy about it, and they didn't release it. The album's come out in varying forms over the last few years. The other week, what people say is the definitive version of it got released. So how many definitive versions you can have of a single one-hour-long song, I don't know. Anyway, when Sleep split up in the wake of that, their singer-guitarist, Matt Pike, formed a very conventional heavy metal group called High on Fire, and the other two members formed a group called Om. Now, I got sent the new album by Om the other day. First time I've ever actually listened to them. I've got a couple at home on the shelves, haven't paid any attention, but I was in the mood for something long and droney.
Some ritualistic chanting.
And truly, Om deliver the drone. There's five tracks on this album. It's three of them are over 10 minutes, the other two are over 5 minutes. There's a very strong Arabic world theme to it. There's a song called Addis, another song called Gethsemane. There's this song, Hak Al Yakin. Now, it's hard to know what to say in terms of kind of praising them to the skies for their phenomenal grasp of song structure or their wonderful chord progressions, because they really don't do very much of that.
Yeah.
They just leave you in one place and go.
That's what I was going to say. There isn't, you know, it's quite stunted, isn't it? There isn't this kind of key change. There aren't, you know, big tempo shifts that you can really hear. It was very much like you're in a place and they're just going with it. They're really running with the
theme.
It's
about the life of the mind.
Right.
It's about you find yourself in that headspace and you just let yourself drift.
Well, Michael, on your journey to Nirvana, you have to just sit back sometimes and take a look, don't you?
You're so wise, Kieran. That's you're like a guru to me. I suspect that even though Dope Smoker was best part of 20 years ago, there may be some possibility that Om do still imbibe the weed, judging by their approach to music.
Yeah.
I know, I'm quite controversial in that way. But what I think is really interesting, the way that underground metal has kind of taken lots of the signifiers of metal away, because Om do still get talked about as a metal group, but you know they've clearly got nothing in common with Slayer or with Bring Me the Horizon or any of the conventional metal groups. It reminds me a lot of Earth, Dylan Carlson's group. What they do is take often metal structures but remove all the signifiers of metal, so all the fuzz guitars, all the vocals, everything like that is taken away, so you get the skeleton of hard rock or heavy metal over which something completely different, often very gentle, sometimes very beautiful, is done. The British group Jesu with Justin Broderick, who used to be in Godflesh, do something similar as well. They tend to more towards the shoegaze end of things, but again, it's taking a metal structure and removing the metallic elements, which is an interesting thing.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's because they're just getting older? They can't go, ah, ah, oh.
They can't do it for an hour anymore. Yeah, they can only keep it up for 10 minutes.
I'm in my mid-40s. I'm a bit more meditative.
The only thing on their
life.
Rider is Lemon and Honey.
Yeah, exactly.
Although that said, Matt Pike and High on Fire, when I've seen High on Fire live, there's no signs of the dimming of the rage. Though there was one unintentionally comedic moment last time I saw them when the bass player was headbanging, as were the people in the front row. And the bass player's headstock got tangled in the hair of someone headbanging in the front row. And they had to do this kind of awkward lean over with the bass player not moving for fear of ripping out the audience member's hair until they finished the song when they could untangle.
It sounds quite like a kind of late 70s kind of prog stroke ambient record, but with more doom.
I think you can hear prog and ambient in this.
Also, the kind of the album, the last couple of albums, I'm seeing the covers and just thinking, you know, they're very kind of religious themed, or I think there was an angel on the last one or something like that. Didn't listen to them because I thought it looked like a bit like an Enigma record. If you remember Enigma,
I remember Enigma.
And actually, occasionally, bits of this, I thought it is like that kind of, you wanted a woman to start whispering at you in French. I'm sorry to all metal fans that I've just compared it to. It doesn't sound like Enigma, but there is a little Venn diagram with a bit in the middle that has Enigma on one side and has Om on the other.
And the bit in the middle is religious chanting.
Yes.
Yeah. I guess one of the things that is interesting about what you were saying about it still being considered as a metal band is that my take on metal bands is kind of conceptually the whole thing is that they can transcend those, forms and rigorous structures or, of what you might get from more mainstream music. And it's in that way, it's a lot freer, isn't it? And this does sound like very, very, very free. It sounds like they don't care about kind of even kind of, you know, about shifts. They don't care about it being so slow moving. They don't care about it being, what, 16 minutes long.
Metal is a very, very broad church. And for some years has been the one of the strands in that church has been the unyielding, unshifting repetition. Sun, the group you see written Sun O, are the leading practitioners of that. I had a friend who went to see them and said he left after half an hour because they hadn't yet got onto their second chord. And frankly, it was a bit too much. Although Sun did give the greatest ever interview, I think it was to The Wire, in which in all seriousness, Stephen O'Malley was talking about the possibility of actually being able to levitate the audience. He was saying, I think what you'd have to do, you'd be playing before you open the doors to the venue. You'd be playing so loud that when the doors opened and the audience walked in, there'd be like a cushion of sound that would lift them up and they would levitate on that. I think more groups ought to consider that. Your whiz kid, he's never thought about that, has he?
Brilliant. What I did like as well is that it's, in the beginning, the drum sound sounded a little bit like tabla, which obviously being an Indian... I really appreciate my ear can hear a tabla from, you know, 10 miles
metal
away.
Metal tabla.
Yeah, exactly. I thought that was quite nice. So then when I was here, I was like, oh, yeah, it's going to be full of these sacred incantations. It's going to be very gentle. And then it sort of started droning on and on. And I was like, oh, no, it's not.
It's interesting. Yeah, droning on and on sounds like a negative, yet in fact, it's such a positive.
Jude, time for your track.
To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black. The cobble streets silent and the hunched quarters and rabbit's wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow black, fishing boat bobbing the sea. The houses are blind as moles, or moles see fine tonight in the snouting velvet dingles, or blind as Captain Cat. There in the muffled middle by the pump and the town.
That was the Dubwood All-Stars with Under Dubwood. Tell us a little bit about that, Jude.
Right, did you find that hilarious or nice or what? It's funny. It kind of has... When I chose this track, I thought, is this too silly? Especially as, obviously, it's Welsh person picking Welsh person. But this is, if for those of you who don't know, this is Richard Burton, a late Welsh actor you may have heard of, reading the first bit of Dylan Thomas's Under Milkwood, a bit where he describes the town of Lleregib, which is bugger all backwards. So this is the DJ Dave Rofe, who is who was a DJ at the Hacienda back in the 80s, has managed Doves and now manages Cherry Ghost. And this is something that he did for the Caught by the River website, which is liked so much they've released it as a 7-inch. So he's got form, and this is it's silly, but I think it works. I never thought... You know, the sounds of King Tubby and Richard Burton would work before. I partly like it because I've always, as a geek of the highest order, I've always been really fascinated with spoken word laid over song from, you know, when I was 10 years old and I've heard my first house record. And there was this old English guy sort of saying, this is a journey into sound from the 1958 record, Journey into Stereo Sound, I think it's called, that was all over early house records. You know, I was fascinated with that. You know, I've always wanted to seek out the spoken word samples. Orbital had a brilliant one on the first track of their new record, a song called One Big Moment. They had Bertrand Russell talking on it from a BBC documentary,
yeah.
And it really, really worked. I think this, although it is a little bit, it has this element of silliness in it, it does really, really work. Also, I brought this in as well because I enjoyed, Kieran, your piece about Poetronica about 3 or 4 months ago, I think, on the Guardian website. And I noticed, now, obviously, Dave Rofe has been around for quite a while and he's doing this possibly for a bit of fun. Mm-hmm. But there does seem to be this movement that people are taking poetry and putting it over, you know, not a recent thing. You know, it's been happening for a little while. And I remember reading you talking about Scream, having linked up with a poet.
Yeah.
So part of this, the appeal of this to me is like, oh, you know, there's things like this going on in general. And part of the appeal is this is the kind of record you're going to hear at every festival this summer.
I really
like the Easy Star All Stars version of Dark Side of the Moon that was out about 5 or 6 years ago, Dub Side of the Moon, which is, there's nothing better to hear when you're, you know, getting to Glastonbury and you're covered in mud, which we won't have the experience of this year, obviously. But I love that. Yeah, it's not just because
that's,
I like
that's what I really liked about it. There's that kind of shift with spoken word traditionally being used with things like hip hop and then moving into electronica, and then I think it works really well in this setting as well. And yeah, I really liked it. Tween Hoffy.
Oh, yes. Very good. She hasn't sworn at me. I said I like it.
Yeah.
I hated it.
I thought
well,
you would.
I didn't hate it. I wonder about my reactions to it and how much I'm reacting to the actual record and how much I'm reacting to what I perceive as the record being all about, which is, of course, the wrong way to think about a record. But, you know, you can't help doing it. It just seemed to me such a model of smug tastefulness. Ah, yes, Richard Burton reading Dylan Thomas. Atop a soundtrack of dub. What better for the people with the feral children to let their kids run around with?
I don't think it's like that at all.
I know, clearly you don't, or you wouldn't have picked it. I'm saying that this is my perceptions, and I accept that my perceptions may very well be wrong. You know, I'd actually rather listen to Richard Burton reading those beautiful, beautiful words without the distraction of the dub underneath. And if I want to listen to dub, I'll go and listen to a dub record without the distraction of Richard Burton over the top. The combination of them makes it seem like some kind of bohemian checklist for look how cool we are to me.
Right. Oh, see, I think it's just
and one of the things that I thought worked was that it's about dreams, isn't it? Sorry, it's about the townspeople, and it's being narrated, and they say it's about their dreams.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's this kind of dreamlike state anyway. And I think that actually, using King Dubby as a backdrop, that kind of dub element gives it a really dreamlike quality, and it isn't as sharp and as slick as Richard Burton on his own might be.
But see, that's kind of why I could have, because I really love this, and I was thinking, is it part because I've always loved Richard Burton's voice, and I being from Swansea, you're schooled in Dylan Thomas from, when you emerge from the womb. So there's that. But I think his voice is so rich and resonant, and the dub is so rich and resonant, that there's a bit where he goes, hush, about, and the babies are sleeping. I just think when with the dub, it's really beautiful. I think it's really beautiful. If this does, Michael, accompany every kind of child-friendly music festival in the summer, it will annoy me, don't get me wrong. However, I really like this, and I don't like it because it's ironic or it's arch. I think it's a bit silly, yes, but I think it really works, and there's something quite lovely about it.
Sure. I have to say, though, Jude, I think there's a fighting chance out of the three tracks picked today. Kieran's might well be the one that is most likely to graze the pop charts.
Do you reckon?
I fear that between us, maybe they could release the Om and the Dublin All-Stars on a double-sided 12-inch single.
We could have, if only Richard Burton was still alive, we could have a collaboration between
be
the
amazing,
three.
Bangers all round.
Maybe we could get a Richard Burton soundalike to do some doomy vocal for Orm as well.
Oh, that'd be great.
But I thought his voice sounded a little bit like the guy on the beginning of Thriller, you know, when he's like,
oh,
you know,
Price,
I thought
do
that.
Mean, do you mean apart from the... Well, I suppose they both have deep resonant voices, don't they? Although Richard Burton's is rather beautiful and Vincent Price's is rather hammy.
Oh, but
quite terrifying.
Both are lovely.
They're both distinctive.
But that was good. Yeah, that's a good singles club because we've got places from all over the world, Michael.
Truly, you can travel the world with singles club without leaving without leaving your front room. But sadly, that does wrap it up for singles club. When the New Zealand expat Willie Moon discovered, much to his surprise, that there had been music before the Beatles, his new sound was born. He fell in love with the music of the 1950s and set about blending it with electronics and some very natty suits. He came into The Guardian to talk to Alexis Petridis.
How did I end up getting involved in music? Through my father, probably. I mean, when I was very small, you know, he used the guitar as a means to escape family life. So I'd go downstairs into the basement of the house and sit down there and play the guitar. He always wore headphones, so I never could actually hear it. But I remember one day going down and spying him, you know, doing this. I was quite small, maybe 5, 6 years old, something like that, and I'd never really seen anything. I didn't really know what he was doing, and from that point on it sort of developed a fascination in me, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where did your interest in kind of 50s rockabilly, that kind of stuff. I mean, that's a very yeah, striking aspect of your sound.
Definitely. I mean, you know, it bloomed very late. You know, it was through my girlfriend. I met my girlfriend after I came to London. And when she moved in with me, she had this little portable record player with an Andrews Sisters record. And I know this is kind of, but I'll get there. But I think it was Rum and Coca-Cola with Boogie Woogie Bebop Boy on the B-side or something. I'd never really listened to music pre sort of 1960s sort of stuff, pre-Beatles, I suppose. Yeah. That was kind of completely, you know, something that I was unaware of. And then this Andrews Sisters record, I heard it and I fell in love with it. Mm-hmm. And through that, I kind of, you know, after that, I moved to Berlin very soon after that. And while I was there, I had a lot of spare time because living was cheap. And this record really excited me. And it took me to places. And I discovered, you know, Bo Diddley and Buddy Holly and Little Richard and all these fantastic characters and all the, you know, doo-wop and that whole world of music. And then, you know, through that, jazz as well.
It's an interesting thing because, you know, you said you didn't listen to stuff from before the Beatles, and I think that's very true of most people.
It's a watermark, isn't it?
Yeah, there's been a sort of foreshortening of musical history, and it's almost like rock and roll begins with Please Please Me by the Beatles. Which means that 50 stuff always seems quite perhaps more arcane and strange.
It is.
You know, than it would have done in the 70s when every band used to come on and, you know, for their encore they would do a whole lot of shaking going on.
Yeah, exactly.
What is its appeal to you?
Raw energy. You know, the same appeal that when, you know, when I was a teenager, I listened to, you know, I liked to listen to NWA and Public Enemy and the Wu-Tang Clan. Same kind of, it inspired the same emotions in me, just that sense of somebody getting in front of a microphone and sort of howling their soul out, and I just loved that.
I mean, it's you're not a retro artiste.
You've got
a lovely quiff on you, but you know, the sound of your records is not a slavish recreation of the 1950s at all.
No.
Where did the sort of idea to put all these kind of electronic elements and sort of bits of dubstep?
No, because I don't want to ghettoize that music. You know, for me, it's an inspiration, but it's not the be all end all. It is not 1956. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? And it never will be again. And I don't want it to be 1956 for so many reasons. I think that would be awful. And so therefore, you know, for me, it's, you know, the means by which I create music is you know, is on a MacBook Pro with Pro Tools, you know, and so therefore, okay, what can I do with this that, you know, that excites me? And I just, you know, there's people who want to go and sort of and make faithful recordings.
Sure.
It blows my mind. It seems bizarre.
Everybody, don't you know it's me now? Yeah, who is it? Who is it? Stay with my ear to the beat now. Yeah, I'm on it, on it.
You say you make music on your MacBook.
Yeah.
Is that an easy thing to take to the live stage in that case? I mean, it's a very dense sound. It's got a lot of electronics in it.
Actually, it was funny. I did a BBC, I did a Radio 1 session yesterday, and it was the first time I'd actually heard what we sound like. I was really pleasantly surprised. I really enjoyed it. I thought it sounded great.
Is it different to the records?
We use elements of tape of backing tracks, so it is, I would say it feels more organic, but I like to keep as many elements of that allow me to maintain the aesthetic of the collision of different music styles as I possibly can. It wouldn't make sense for me just to have a straightforward rock and roll band, because that's not what I do.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I have a guitarist and drummer and a DJ, and then we sort of run things off tracks and things like that. It's fantastic.
It's an interesting thing, because I was thinking about what you do this morning, and I was thinking about it in the context of other artists. And you actually exist in quite a grand tradition of people taking 50s music.
Definitely.
And sticking it together with electronics, right? Suicide, them.
I love Suicide. I literally had one of their records in Berlin that I just destroyed because I played it so many times.
Yeah. It's interesting. And then there was a thing in Britain in the 80s where there was simultaneously this sort of sense, I think, of people looking for a futuristic kind of music, while there was a sort of there was a 50s revival because of Levi's ads. You had people like Westworld and...
I
was just sort of intrigued by this sort of... I think strand that runs through pop of this notion of this the most basic rock and roll you can get, and sort of going, right, we'll sort of make it futuristic.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, look at what was, and I think still is, you know, Queen's biggest worldwide hit, which is Crazy Little Thing Called Love, or, you know, or George Michael with Faith, do you know what I mean? Which is essentially a Bo Diddley record.
Yeah.
When you have something, a style of music that is so simple, I think it's impossible for it not to feed into everything else because it's so basic that when people are looking to move back to something that's to strip back their songwriting to something that's simple, it's just natural that is going to, you know, feed into it.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's a good thing because I think it's music that's been really overlooked in sort of British.
There's not that much there though. I mean, it's, you know, 50s music. There's not that much there.
No.
There's not that much to be overlooked. Once you get a handle on it, there are certain artists who are a little bit more strange, like, you know, like people like Johnny Burnett and stuff, a little bit more on the, where it gets a little bit more psychedelic and then go leading into sort of some 60s stuff.
No, it's interesting though. You also get those kind of weird doo-wop records that I think by default rather than by design end up sounding weirdly futuristic because they're so,
like,
I mean, I Only Have Eyes for You is the sort of obvious example. You just had like a record from Mars, you know? But clearly that wasn't their intention to make some sort of weird futuristic record. It's just, you know, cheap echo turned up to 10 sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, all there's a recording of Sleepwalk by Betsy Bry. Do you know Betsy Bry? Absolutely fantastic. It's another, you know, reverb turned up to 11. Do you know? I mean, it's just ridiculous and sounds fantastic. The weirdness, though, comes from association. I don't think it's the weirdness that we see in it, you know, through looking back to the 50s and we expect something that's so sort of anodyne and then we find something that sounds a little bit strange, we suddenly read so much of that into it.
Absolutely, yes, it's very easy to go, well, of course, you know, the atomic age, you know what I mean? Yeah, and there is those kind of weird 50s notions of futurism that don't really seem to link to the music at all on one level, because it's rootsy stuff, you know, while you have this kind of weird futuristic world being played out in the cinema and things like that. It's not like rock.
It is bizarre, isn't it? That disconnection.
It's not like rock. Or you know, or the kind of novelty with that flying saucer rock and roll or things like that. You just don't really get anybody sort of thinking, "I'm going to make the music of the future here." You know, it's kind of weird.
Joe Meek did a little bit of that.
Joe Meek did, yeah. Kind of, yeah. Yeah. Suppose he did, didn't he? Yes.
Yeah. He was definitely into science fiction.
Like, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
The occult.
What's next for you? What's
next for me?
Yeah.
You know, I want to make. I'm in the process of making a record, an album, which I hope to. I really want to try and make sort of a collage of everything that excites me and that has inspired me. So that's my personal sort of vision for how I want to go about it.
Have you played live much?
I've played live a bit. I mean, you know, literally though, compared to other people. I mean, I've still only played live about sort of, you know, 7 or 8 times.
Right.
I really look forward to doing more of it. It's so much fun.
Is it?
Oh yeah, and it's a lot of fun. You know, I just blank out. I just go up there and kind of blank out and just sing and then walk off stage and sort of a little bit,
feel
a little bit rubbery, you know, and that's it. It's great.
That was Willie Moon talking to Alexis.
And that's it for this week. Thanks to Jude for being our guest.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Jude.
We'll be back next week, but until then, leave your thoughts at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly and have a great weekend.
Guardian podcasts are partnered with audible.co.uk. For a free download, be sure to check out guardian.co.uk/audible, where Guardian listeners can choose any audiobook for free. See the page for more details.